All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, February 17th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday. My phone says it's 4 degrees here. So at least it's better than the -5 it was before I went to bed. It's a bit overcast. I don't know. I guess today we're supposed to get up to 20. Woohoo! It will be the one day in... oh, I don't know, probably 5 days since we've been in the even above single digits. And then guess what? We're going back down to single digits again. Pretty miserable. But you know what? It's Tuesday and we have all kinds of stuff to talk about today. We have been on a kick now. This is week number 5, looking at all kinds of crazy technologies and how they connect together. We finally made it to nanotech and food. And I'm thinking that I want to get back to nanotech and food, except that we might need to take a little itty-bitty detour before we get right into nanotech and food. There were a couple stories last night that I found before. Well, I had a couple rounds of searching. And I wanted to share them with you. But one of them, I actually, RT News, and let me see if I can hook me up here. RT released a video with the scientist. He's the head of the Future Institute, I think it was called, that put out that report over the weekend about the 12 causes of the apocalypse. They interviewed the guy who's in charge of that group out of Oxford University. And I wanted to play you just the end part, because remember, number one out of the things that they believe most probable to cause the apocalypse, number one was artificial intelligence. And, you know, I mean, I've been squawking about this stuff forever, but we've also, hold on, I'm going to kill this. We've also had Elon Musk coming out multiple times. We've had Stephen Hawking, who, by the way, belongs to that scientific group at Oxford University. I think that's where he works out of. You know, there have been very well-respected, smart people, scientists, who've said, whoa, back the truck up, Chuck, because guess what? There are no morals or ethics or standards boards. Nobody's watching the ship, and we are just careening out of control with these mad scientists gone mad, creating whatever the hell they want, and then worrying about it later. So, you know, I actually saw something about Musk when I was digging into that nanotech and some of what Sophia Smalstrom was saying. You know, I was doing my Google, you know, you'll do a search on YouTube and then all your suggested videos down the side come up. And that helps a lot when you don't know what you're looking for, because you'll find other stuff. But Elon Musk had come up down the side, and there was a little quote in the title that must have been that same speech that he gave, where he was saying that AI is not a good idea. And he put money where his mouth is to actually help figure out how to protect us against AI. I think he put in like $35 million or something. But he, the little quote that was in the title was something like, we're summoning the demon with AI. And I was like, whoa, I didn't hear him say that. But he's absolutely right. I mean, once, and even Kurzweil. And I mean, Kurzweil is such a nerdy little piece of shit. But you know what? He's a smart fucker. And Kurzweil's going to do it. And if we see... even the stuff we watched the other day was from 2005 for Kurzweil, okay, when he was talking about, oh, Sophia, actually it was yesterday, Sophia played that little excerpt of his documentary. 2005, he already was calling all the stuff that we're just seeing now hit the tips of the news. And I know you guys will say, oh, they got it 50 years or even, you know, 20 years ahead of time. They absolutely do. And I think we're going to be in for some big fat surprises that we're not quite expecting yet. So anyway, here, let me play this. This is the RT interview with the gentleman who did the 12 causes of the apocalypse. I truncated it. It's a 6-minute clip. So I truncated it to from 4 minutes on, because he just talks about artificial intelligence. But I thought you would find this pretty interesting. So here we go. This is with Ben Swan.
So let's step over then, because you're talking about technology, to the issue that really is, I guess, the biggest risk here, because most of these risks that you all listed never really climb much above 0.1% possibility. Many of them have the 0.00003% chance, except for one. There was this one risk that actually had up to a 10% chance of actually wiping out humanity from the face of the planet. Artificial intelligence. The report reads, when it comes to artificial intelligence, if motivations do not detail the survival and the value of humanity, the intelligence will be driven to construct a world without humans. This makes extremely intelligent AIs a unique risk, in that extinction is more likely than lesser impacts. On a more positive note, an intelligence of such power could easily combat most other risks in this report, making extremely intelligent AI into a tool of great potential. So, am I reading this correctly that in short, artificial intelligence will first save humanity from all these other disasters, then destroy humanity possibly to preserve itself? That's a risk.
AI is a very interesting risk, and it's the one with some of the biggest unknowns there. And it's because if you have an artificial intelligence, you have another player if you want. A meteor impact will happen, it'll be an accident. The meteor has no goals or no designs. An AI, on the other hand, does have goals and designs, and that's the problem. That's what makes it so difficult both to deal with and to predict. And part of the reason is that it's actually really hard for a natural disaster, even a pandemic, unless you get to really huge and ridiculously huge asteroids, to cause the extinction of the human population. Killing a large chunk of us is doable, in sort of numerical terms, but getting everyone gets a lot harder for all these natural disasters. But AI with intentionality, the game is entirely different. Now, however, there's been some recent positive developments on the AI front. People are taking it more seriously and doing some research. So there does these unknown probabilities have probably gone down a bit in the last year.
Well, I would say at this point, what we would have to do is keep an eye certainly on what you're describing here. A number of scientists, as you know, have already warned about this, the possibilities. And of course, we'll have to keep an eye on whether or not John Connor is, in fact, the face and the voice of the resistance. Stuart Armstrong of the Humanity Institute at Oxford University, excuse me, the Future of Humanity Institute. We hope it's a bright one. Thanks so much, Stuart.
The Future of Humanity Institute. Except the list that they put out are the 12 ways we're going to bite the dust. Yeah, that's the future of humanity. Thanks. And you know, something else I forgot. Another one who weighed in on the future of AI just recently was Bill Gates. Remember that? Bill Gates fears AI, but AI researchers know better. Boop-a-da-boo. The general obsession with super intelligence is only getting bigger and bigger. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bill Gates to the AI panic of 2015. I mean, check this out. They're like making it like it's a joke, except, you know, I wish I could poke Bill Gates in the eyes. But I'm going to tell you what, he's a very rich dude and he's been around for a long time. He understands technology. So the fact that Gates also came out, and this was actually during an Ask Me Anything session on Reddit back in January, the fact that he came out and expressed concern over AI as well with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking, you know, some rinky-dink popular science magazine. I mean, popular science isn't rinky-dink, but for popular science magazine to be going, ugh, nothing to be concerned about, I don't think I'd be listening to popular science. During an Ask Me Anything session on Reddit, in January, a user by the name of Beastcoin asked the founder of Microsoft a rather excellent question, quote, "How much of an existential threat do you think machine superintelligence will be? And do you believe full end-to-end encryption for all internet activity can do anything to protect us from that threat?" the more the machines can't know, the better. Well, I don't think encryption is going to help anyone, because any type of supercomputer will be able to crack any type of encryption. But one of the things that I did want to mention, too, and maybe I can hop to that since we're on the technology thing after this before we get back into the nanotechnology, is Obama's executive order. I don't know if you guys saw that, but there was a hack of over 100 international banks. We knew this was coming. Remember when they had said, oh, Windows XP, we're no, was it XP? Yeah, it was XP, Windows XP. We're no longer supporting it. And today's the last day, and we had extended it already, so tough shit, because if you didn't upgrade, you're not getting any more security patches. And then it comes out like that same day even. Oh, hey, guess what? 95% of all the banks are running Windows XP. We're like, no shit, if we were a hacker, that would be the next place you hit. Or if you were a government paid hacking group and you wanted to boost business for what? Oh, former NSA Cyber Patrol head chief Keith Alexander, who's now in the private sector and went to JP Morgan Chase and held their feet to the fire and said, if you don't hire me, we're going to hack you. Yeah, that same one. Well, guess what? Over 100 international banks were hacked. They began by saying over $300 million was siphoned. But now, I saw videos of Pigmine was posting this morning. They're saying over $1 billion may have been stolen. And over the weekend, Obama put on his bunny slippers and did an executive order for internet security, pulling together, yes, just exactly what we said, public and private partnership into the big, happy, mutated, butt-slapping, slippery palm family of surveillance state. I predict now that Microsoft's Cyber Patrol Center will probably be the big rotten cherry on top. All right, but I said too much. Let's get back to Bill Gates and his Reddit in January, where he was asked whether or not he should be afraid of the machine. During an AMA Ask Me Anything session on Reddit this past Wednesday, a user by the name of Beastcoin asked the founder, oh yeah, we read this already, and do we think we should be afraid of the machine? And if we encrypted everything, would it keep us safe? But sadly, Gates did not address the second half of the question because it was a dumb question. Of course. I mean, if you had right now a supercomputer can probably crack encryption if given enough time. And if you had some sort of cipher that was changing like every 3 seconds and it was in all kinds of strange characters, I don't know, maybe, but I don't think any encryption is safe, honestly, if given enough brain power. Gates did not address the second half of the question, but he said, I am in a camp that is concerned about superintelligence. First, the machines will do a lot of jobs for us and not be super intelligent. And remember, he had come out a while ago and said that the robots were all going to take our jobs, too. And that's kind of what the promise has been for a long time, except when they take our jobs. And I mean, we're talking dumb jobs. We're talking like the jobs that no one really wants, the simple jobs. But when all those jobs are gone, I mean, we don't have any manufacturing jobs. Everything is pretty much a service job now, or a high-tech technology job. It's all going to be in genomics or artificial intelligence or things of that nature. And you know, it's not going to be a job that everybody can get. So those service jobs are going to be the jobs that they are. But once they're gone, once the robots take them all, we're just going to become the guinea pig, I think. We are unnecessary at that point. We are adding to the carbon quotient. And remember, Gates wants the carbon quotient to go to zero. Anyway, I'm going to continue. He says that should be positive if we manage it well, and that is the first machines doing all the jobs for us. A few decades after that thought, the intelligence is strong enough to be a concern. I agree with Elon Musk and some others on this and don't understand why some people are not concerned, he said. From robophobics, The anti-artificial intelligence dream team is nearly complete. Elon Musk and Bill Gates had the cash and the clout, while legendary cosmologist Stephen Hawking, whose widely covered fears include both evil robots and predatory aliens. Yes, he did. He said, you know, he's not the first one either to say we should go get that Voyager probe. There was another cosmologist that had come out and said, and I think he's absolutely right, just like in the old days, any advanced civilization that came upon a less advanced civilization, what happened to them? Oh, they were completely obliterated and enslaved. So the fact that we sent out Voyager with all the great diagrams and drawings of humans and DNA and sounds of our voices and music and a big map going, we are here. I don't know if I'm really looking forward to the day that that big mothership shows up and goes, thank you. Food, dinner. I don't know. Yes, predatory aliens. They will not be our friends and it will not be ET. But hey, maybe we'll have evil artificial intelligence by that time to attack for us. Anyway, I digress. Elon Musk and Bill Gates have the cash and the clout, while legendary cosmologist Stephen Hawking, whose widely covered fears include both evil robots and predatory aliens, brings his incomparable intellect. All they are missing is the muscle, someone willing to get his or her hands dirty in the preemptive war with killer machines. Well, actually, what these nascent AI Avengers really need is something even more far-fetched. Any indication that artificial superintelligence is a tangible threat or even a serious research priority. Now, one second here. Popular science. What has popular science ever done from the deep multi-billion dollar research perspective that some little yank who wrote this? Eric Sofj. How much research have you done, Eric Sofj, to be calling, and not that I'm standing up for Bill Gates, but he's like one of the founders, to be calling Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and Stephen Hawking basically idiots? Wow. Well, I hope you get some demerits for that, because that's pretty crazy to be, you know, one of the things that when in the day when we used to believe that Bill Gates was not evil, we would watch his yearly Microsoft statement that he would give at the beginning of every year. They'd post it on their website and he would see the vision for the future. And he would give an amazing speech every year about what he saw coming in technology. And you know what? Billy was on every single time. And of course, because they probably already had it in the pipeline for research and development. But on the other hand, he's one of those visionaries. He can see what he wants to make happen. And he has enough money and enough hands and enough people working for him that he can make it happen. That's why in this, what do you call it? You donate money. I don't remember. Remember, guys, I am only on a quarter cup right now, but it is a little bit warmer out here. In his Bill and Melinda Gates position that he's in now, for donating and whatever and being the global vacker, you know, that's what worries me about him, because Gates knows what's coming, and the fact that he's invested in all these different things as well as in Monsanto under the guise of saving the world, you know, don't think that he already knows what the plan is. And I know we do think so. I don't know. Anyone, this popular science guy that's calling bullshit on all this, I think he needs to get a clue, or even maybe even just half of one. All right, but he does call it out. He says, well, maybe I'm wrong, though. We're too dead set on countering the growing hysteria surrounding AI research to see the first glimmers of monstrous sentience gestating in today's code. Perhaps Gates, Hawking, and Musk, by virtue of being incredibly smart guys, know something that I don't. Well, at least he got it. So here's what some prominent AI researchers had to say on the topic. And I don't know. I'm not going to read, like, his whole thing. It's a pretty long story, but I will drop this to you. We did see Jibo, though. Remember Jibo? Hello, Jibo. What I wanted to bring up to you, though, is in reading all this, I was like, well, what about Google's new neural network that they've been working on for quite a while? So I dug into that last night, and sure enough, I mean, this guy to say that there's nothing to worry about, they're definitely moving it along. Google and Stanford build a hybrid neural network that can explain photos. Now, this was one of the big obstacles that they had for a long time, was to be able to look at a scene and to decode what is happening in the scene. Not just looking at a photo and saying, that is a dog, that is a tree. But to be able to look at a photo and say, that is a dog jumping over an obstacle and playing with his ball. That is a construction worker in an orange safety vest working on a road. And they've done that. That was as of September of 2014. Two separate groups of researchers at Google and Stanford have merged the best-of-breed neural network models and created systems that can accurately explain what is happening in images. Although their approaches differ, full papers are available here and here for both Stanford and for Google. I'll drop this in chat after, and as well as put this into the notes on YouTube once the show rips. Both groups essentially combined deep convolutional neural networks, the type of deep learning models responsible for the huge advances in computer vision accuracy over the past few years, with recurrent neural networks that excel at text analysis and natural language processing. Now, one of the things, too, that way back in the beginning when I started reading about this project, I thought they were in bed with the NSA for being able to scrape unformatted text anywhere in the internet, and that's why they were using Google in the search engine, to be able to learn not only what words are saying, but what words are implying. So if you write something and you don't actually say something, but you know you have your secret words that refer to something, and once they started seeing patterns, and they wanted it to be able to learn slang on the fly. I am pretty sure that this is the project that it kind of morphed into. Recurrent neural networks have been responsible for some of the significant improvements in language understanding recently, including machine translation that powers, Microsoft's Skype Translate and Google's Word2Vec libraries. So I guess that means that for any of us that have international friends that speak another language, yes, the Microsoft Google Neural Network bot will know everything we say. In a comment on a Hacker News post pointing to a New York Times story about the research out of Google and Stanford, one of the authors of the Stanford paper points to similar points, similar research also coming out of Beidou and UCLA, which, by the way, Beidou is the project happening in China for the neural computer. And the one who is in charge of that, and I don't remember his name, it's NG is his last name. He's one of the co-founders of the original Google neural network, but he left Google, and I believe Hecty even told me that. If you're out there, Hecty, happy birthday. One of the co-founders of Google's neural network computer left and went to Beidou, which is a huge internet service provider, I guess, in China, and is working now to build them a neural network supercomputer as well. But there's also similar research coming out of Beidou and UCLA, the University of Toronto, and the University of California, Berkeley. Coincidentally, the University of Toronto's research and Google Distinguished Scholar, Jeff Hinton. Ooh. Now, isn't Jeff Hinton? I thought he was the big brain research guy that they brought on right around the time of Kurzweil. And remember, guys, Kurzweil then wants to upload to the machine. So what better way to do that but to have a super intelligent artificial neural network? You know that these are all connected. That's why I'm talking about this, but this just became more news the other day. So, but it's all connected to what we've been talking about. All right. I don't know if we're going to dig too much more into this. You can read all up on Google and Stanford's hybrid neural network that promises AI in the future. You know, remember, we have stuff happening faster and faster as there is better and better technology, faster and faster computers. And, you know, we have this today, and next year it's going to be 10 times more powerful. So don't for a minute think that this is some sort of joke. I also last night found, I think this was from 1993. No, wait, hold on, let me find out. Oh, 2003. December 12th, 2003, indexed in Google's patent service, the brain-computer interface. It's an electrocorticography-based brain-computer interface and related methods are described. The description, it's a statement regarding federally sponsored research and development. This invention is based in part on research performed with the U.S. government grant support under grant number, and it gives the numbers, blah, 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 three different of them, from the National Institute of Health. Hey, guess what? They're right smack dab in the middle of the brain project. The U.S. government has certain rights in this invention. Isn't that nice? They own and have rights to a computer brain interface, just like the ones that they're probably using on soldiers. And lo and behold, they now are talking about some new therapies out there that will give us relief from depression. Well, yes, as we look around and read stories about the 12 ways the apocalypse is going to happen, we're going to get depressed, but don't worry about it. Because guess what? They got a treatment for that now. I just got to read this headline and then we're going to move on. This is the headline. Implantation of electrodes deep within the brain is now commonly performed for treatment of the neurological disorders of Parkinson's disease and essential tremors. But the use of deep brain stimulation, as it is known, is expanding. It is now being assessed in as many as 200 patients. So that sounds like a clinical trial now, doesn't it? First on the block, it is now being assessed in as many as 200 patients for major depression and is also being considered for other disorders such as anorexia. Yes, anorexia and depression. We are going to implant electrodes deep within your brain. And that should fix it. That was out of Scientific American. But even better, people, we have talked before about DNA storage. Do you remember that? This is probably a year, year and a half ago. I had brought this up quite a number of times. And every time I thought about DNA storage, I'd start to envision some sort of Jabba the Hutt blob of flesh. But I remember the first story that I read about DNA storage, and it had said that in a pound of flesh or biological matter, they could literally store every butterfly wing that had flapped, every word ever uttered, anything that has ever occurred within the history of all of mankind and life on the planet Earth in a pound of this DNA. Well, science alert last night. A DNA hard drive has been built that can store data now for up to a million. Yes, that's right. A million years. Is that not like the NSA's biggest wet dream ever? And, you know, that's the thing that freaks me out is Kurzweil's been talking about that forever, is how, and in some of the clips we heard yesterday, he mentioned this, how DNA is actually a biological computer. And they've said that forever, except it's way more complicated than just the zeros and ones that we have. Those are only two operands, zero and one. So they can either be on, off, both on, both off, right? That's all it is. You got actually three choices, unless you distinguish between which position they're in, if it's on the right or the left. But with DNA, you had four, C, A, T, and G. Manipulate the proteins, put them in different locations. You can have all kinds of permutations. And now, remember, they have created alien, quote unquote, alien DNA. And that is with CATG and then the two new proteins, X and Y. And they said, oh, this will allow us to build all kinds of amazing things. Yeah. Not just pharmaceuticals and creatures, but it gives them an exponential growth. It's kind of like in the computer world, if you understand anything about IP addressing, IP version 4 gives you only so many stanzas of numbers to work with. And I'm not really going to get into the way hexadecimal works or IP addressing, but you have four sections of numbers, and those numbers can only go from 0 to 255. And actually, in your first section of numbers and IP addressing, oh, I don't remember when it starts for public addressing, but outside numbers on the real outside internet don't start until, I don't know, I'm trying to think. 192 is always inside, but actually there's lots of numbers. So maybe it's up until 192 because I've seen 172, but I've seen bigger too. So I don't know. I've seen 173. I don't know. Been a long time. I haven't done engineering in a long time. But anyway, those numbers are limited. And so to get beyond IPv4, because the Internet of Things was coming, just like Eric Schmidt had talked about, the CEO of Google, where everything is going to be connected to the Internet. Regina Duggan, part of the unholy trinity at one point for Google, she was doing the smart devices with the Motorola and Samsung. The Internet of Things, swallow a smart pill, and every one of us will be a node on the network. Well, now it's come to swallow a smart pill loaded with nanobots, and every cell in your body now becomes a node on the network that they can track, bag, and tag. Well, there weren't enough addresses in the combinations for the old version of IP to be able to support all that. So, over the last probably 10 years, I'd say, close to it, they've all been migrating routers and numbering schemes to what they call IPv6. And IPv6, version 6, now extends, so you have multiple more of those stanzas, I call them, but whatever, blocks of numbers. Instead of 4, I believe it went to 6. So it's a dot. Three numbers added to the end, which gives you all this additional, like close to unlimited, never can, but I mean, if we do it at a cellular level, who knows? We're going to have to go to IPv8. But you can number every node that we at least have right now from a commercial perspective with IPv6. I don't know how I got, oh, talking about DNA being a biological computer. Yes. And by adding additional proteins to DNA, we've now expanded it exponentially. That's what that came from. All right. So let's get back up to this DNA hard drive that can store data for a million years. And every NSA asshole is just salivating, dribbling on his T-shirt with his belly sticking out, going, sounding like Jabba the Hutt. All right. When you think of humanity's legacy, I'm sorry, guys, I'm a little slap happy. It is school vacation week up here. I know the rest of the country typically doesn't have it, but we do here. So I'm doing this big juggling this week, and it's driving me loopy. All right, when you think humanity's legacy, the most powerful message for us to leave behind for future civilizations would surely be our billions of terabytes of data. But right now, the hard drive and disks that we use to store all this information are frustratingly vulnerable and unlikely to survive more than a couple hundred years. Fortunately, scientists have built a DNA time capsule that is capable of safely preserving all of our data for more than a million years. And we are kind of freaking out over how huge the implications are. Researchers already knew that DNA was ideal for data storage. In theory, just 1 gram of DNA is capable of holding 455 exabytes, which is equivalent to 1 billion gigabytes and more than enough space to store all of Google, Facebook, and pretty much everyone else's data. Storing information on DNA is also surprisingly simple. Researchers just need to program the A and C base pairs of DNA as a binary zero and the T and G as one. So that's what they're doing. They're actually making them double pairs, so zeros and ones. But I was reading something where then they could actually take that when they get into quantum computing. There's all kinds of other crazy stuff that they can do. But the researchers led by Robert Grass from ETH Zurich in Switzerland wanted to find out just how long this data would last. DNA can definitely be durable. In 2013, scientists managed to sequence genetic code from 700,000-year-old horse bones, but it has to be preserved in pretty specific conditions. Otherwise, it could break and change and break down as it is exposed to the environment. So Glass's team decided to try to replicate a fossil to see if it would help them create a longer-lasting DNA hard drive. Similar to these bones, we wanted to protect the information-bearing DNA with synthetic, there we go again, oh how exciting, synthetic fossil shell, he explained. In order to do that, the team encoded Switzerland's Federal Charter of 1921 and the methods of mechanical theorem by Archimedes onto a DNA strand, a total of 83 kilobytes of data. That's kind of a waste. And then encapsulated the DNA into what? Tiny glass spheres, which were around 150 nanometers in diameter. The researchers compared these glass spheres against other packaging methods by exposing them to temperatures between 60 to 70 degrees Celsius, conditions that replicated the chemical degradation that would usually occur over 100 years, and crammed it all into a few destructive weeks. They found that even after the sped-up degradation process, the DNA inside the glass spheres could easily be extracted using a fluoride solution. Oh, go figure. And the data on it could still be read. In fact, these glass casings seem to work much like fossilized bones. Based on their results, which have been published in the Angewandte Chemie, the team predicts that data stored on DNA could survive over 1 million years if it was stored in temperatures below minus 18 degrees Celsius, for example, in a facility. Oh, that's exactly what I was thinking. In the facility like the Svald Global Seed Vault. You know what? That's the place for all the heritage seeds, and now it'll be the place for all the heritage human DNA once the hybrids take over. Jeez, come on. Which, of course, is also known as the Doomsday Vault. Oh, how interesting it comes back full circle. I'm telling you guys, the genie's out of the bottle. And if there wasn't a reason to say, yeah, it is, this is it, they're going to start storing fossilized human DNA in the Doomsday Vault for when we need to go seed a new planet and we've blown ourselves up. They say it could last 2,000 years of stored somewhere else less secure at 10 degrees Celsius, which is a similar average temperature to Central Europe. The tricky part of this whole process is that DNA, data stored in DNA, needs to be read properly in order for future civilizations to be able to access it. And despite advances in sequencing technology, errors still arise from DNA sequencing. The team overcame this by embedding a method for correcting any errors within the glass spheres, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. We don't really need to get into all of this, but just know data can be stored for up to 1 million years if it were put into the Doomsday Vault. All right. I don't know. Should we get to, there's a couple things. Maybe we're going to have to get back to nanotech tomorrow because there are a few things. I wanted to talk about something I ran across the other day too, and it was probably a month ago, and we never got to it. But it was the first I had read about this, and now I see that there's a whole 101 class online, and it's called DNA barcoding. And that, to me, just the name DNA barcoding is extremely disturbing. Knowing that we have Watson, IBM's Watson, involved in our healthcare coming future soon to a doctor's office near you or a VA's office near you, to know that the genomics project has been such a major success, and now with this precision medicine, geneticists, your doctor, biopharma, nanotech, FDA regulators, and venture capitalists are all going to be involved in your healthcare. To hear that DNA barcoding is some big new great thing that we're doing education in and teaching kids all about and have 101 simplistic things online should make you worry. The experiment using DNA barcodes to identify and classify living things. Remember, the database, once it's all in the database, they can do anything with it. And if you remember the story we read about 2 weeks ago with them mapping all of the bacterial DNA on the subway system in New York City and how they could build an entire map from that, trust me, this isn't good. This means the absolute clamped lockdown at a genetic level for surveillance. All right, experiments using DNA barcodes to identify and classify living things. Taxonomy, which is the science of classifying living things according to shared features, has always been a part of human society. Identifying organisms has grown in importance as we monitor the biological effects of, climate change? Yes, bzz, bzz, bzz. And attempt to preserve species diversity in the face of accelerated habitat destruction and, of course, extinctions. Less than 2 million of the estimated 5 to 50 million plant and animal species have been identified. Classical taxonomy falls short in this race to catalog biological diversity before it disappears. Now, DNA barcodes allow non-experts to objectively identify species, even from small, damaged, or industrial process material. And just as the unique pattern of a universal product code, the UPC, identifies each consumer product, a DNA barcode is a unique pattern of DNA sequence that identifies each living thing. So between your DNA barcode and your Internet of Things IP address, your bodily Internet IP address, Internet of Things IP address, they'll know everything there is to know about your location, what you do, what you eat, what goes into your body, what comes out of your body, what you think, what you breathe. I mean, the fast forward even just 50 years and I go, holy shit, I probably won't be here 50 years. I'm going to be probably close to 100. So unless they hold me down and they make me take some longevity nanotechnology, I probably won't be here. A DNA barcode is a unique pattern of DNA sequence that identifies each living thing. Short DNA barcodes, about 700 nucleotides in length, can be processed from thousands of specimens and unambiguously analyzed by computer programs. Isn't that freaking great? All right, so as someone who worked on a massive, 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 massive barcoding project back in the early 90s when it was new and novel, this is very scary to me. All right, let's connect here. There's a little video. I don't know, though. It is, I don't know if we're even going to go here. We're running out of time. It's 45 minutes long. So, well, let me play the very beginning and see what it says. I don't know. We'll check it out. DNA barcoding, isolating. We're gonna get
started, but you can see that I have a lot of equipment physically here to do this DNA isolation. So one thing I do want to promote is safety in the laboratory. So one thing that I do recommend is that you're going to need some gloves to physically wear. So I'm going to put these on. And you should also be wearing some type of protective eyewear, whether it be glasses or lab glasses or lab goggles. But you know, you need to make sure that you're wearing something protective over your eyes. Okay. I'm wearing my glasses, so I think I'll push on with that. All right. So let's talk about everything that you're going to physically need here. First things first, you're going to need some samples. So I have three sets of samples here, and I have some plants, some sort of meat. This is pork, actually, and I have an insect here, which is actually going to be my house cricket. I'll pull these out in just a second, but we still have numerous other things to physically go through here. One of the things I will propose is that you've got to have a notebook around. You've got to be able to jot down notes about your material, so please have your notebook nearby so that you can keep notes of everything that's happening. You're obviously going to need something to write with, so you should have a pen around and a marker.
This is awesome.
Your samples. And then you should have your protocol available to you with any notes that you need on that as well. So please make sure you have all these things physically around with you. Okay. Now, let's get to the immediate things that we need. We're going to need some reagents. So I have a set of reagents over here.
You know what? We're not going to go into this. Anyway, and there's a whole website called DNA Barcoding 101, and they're targeting students. Like, they're showing preteen students even working at barcoding in the classroom, the Urban Barcode Project. And this is through the five boroughs of New York City. They have made it possible from funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for them, grades 9 through 12, to use DNA barcoding to explore biodiversity in New York City. And this is the future, people. DNA barcoding. Scan the back of your neck. You know, if you get down to biometrics, and that's something we haven't heard anything about really in the recent past, but it was getting pretty huge there for a while. This should be very frightening too. All right, let me close a few windows because we are getting short on time now, and I am nowhere near where I wanted to be. Okay. Let's get back to my page. All right, the one thing I wanted to share with you is a story that came out yesterday, the day before, about Bob Simon, who is the CBS reporter that just a few days ago in New York City had that horrible car accident that killed him. And Nick Burnaby was telling me, actually, and I looked it up last night, there have been four MSM reporters just over the last couple, I don't even think it's the last couple weeks, I think they were all within like 24 or 48 hours of each other, that all died. And you know, people are throwing around all kinds of theories. Oh, they all dealt with the Iraq war and blah, blah, blah. Well, maybe. Or maybe they were just natural deaths. The one guy that just died, I saw the autopsy report, said he had lung cancer. He dropped dead at work. So I'm not going to call it conspiracy theory, but one thing that was extremely interesting, they came out with almost a, they were doing like a tribute to him on 60, well, about him on his 60 Minutes special last night on CBS, is that, did you know, all this crap we've been talking about with vaccines and all the different ways that they can make vaccines with the, and you guys, back about 6, 8, 10 months ago, maybe even a year ago, I was going apeshit about that genetically modified tobacco, right? That was part of the Blue Angel Project, financed by DARPA. They'd started at Texas A&M University. We had now, like, R.J. Reynolds was involved. They had bought a part of the facility, and they're using GMO tobacco, and they're making the solution. They're drowning the tobacco in the solution, so it sucks it up. Then they're taking, like, mouse cells and infecting them with Ebola in this case, and then they're sucking out the mouse genes, and they're putting human genes in there, and then they're making these antigens, and then the plants replicate it and suck it all up, and then you have a whole field of all this tobacco, Frankenstein tobacco, that then is going to produce an antigen that then can become a vaccine. Well, this is the way they were making that ZMAP, if you remember, during the quote-unquote Ebola crisis. And as I dug into ZMAP, and I dug into it back during the Ebola thing as well, there was a lot of federal funding that had gone into this. But let me just play you this little tribute to Bob Simon, because he did an expose on the secret facility where they were growing all this stuff. And he kind of pointed out that, huh, though there was all this promise, it really wasn't going too well at the end. Here, check this out. So this is Bob Simon's last 60 Minutes report, curing Ebola. Here it comes.
Friends and family will remember correspondent Bob Simon tomorrow in New York. He was killed in a car crash last week. Bob had just finished a 60 Minutes report on the development of ZMapp, a promising drug to treat Ebola, a disease that has killed 9,000 in its latest outbreak in West Africa. Bob's reporting took him to a secure lab in Canada, as well as to a series of greenhouses in Owensboro, Kentucky.
This is where the science has turned into a product, where ZMapp is manufactured in row after row of this odd-looking variety of tobacco.
Can I smoke it? Can I chew it?
I wouldn't recommend that.
But it's different?
It's very different.
Hugh Hayden is the president of Kentucky Bioprocessing, which was recently bought by cigarette giant Reynolds American.
When you say tobacco to most people today, it suggests cancer and emphysema, heart failure, death.
No question, there's
a bit of
irony.
Tobacco is known in our culture as a killer.
There's clearly a bit of irony there, but again, there are good things that can be done with it, and that's our objective here.
But ZMapp isn't easy to produce. It takes 6 weeks. The tobacco plants first have to be grown for 24 days. Then they're immersed in a liquid containing a gene that tells them to make special antibodies which help the immune system fight viruses, in this case, Ebola. As the plants grow, they copy those antibodies over and over again.
Xerox machine for antibodies.
That's essentially what it does. It makes it over and over and over again.
The leaves are then ground up into a liquid, which looks like a juice you'd buy at a health food store. Since ZMapp is made up of three different antibodies, the process has to be repeated three times using 6,000 pounds of new tobacco plants. And the yield?
How much ZMapp will you get out of three tables like this? How many people can you cure of Ebola if it works?
It would be dozens.
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 Which is not very much.
Not very.
You know, when I heard that, like, so remember when we were looking at all this mad science gone mad vaccination creation that was going on and everybody bumping into each other to try and be the first ones to come up with an Ebola cure. You know, the stock market speculators, investors were all going nuts because it was a money-making panacea that was coming. And for this guy to be on 60 Minutes with Bob Simon, who's been in the industry for many years, and I mean, 60 Minutes has been around since I was a kid, and be interviewed and show their secret facility and then have them go, oh my God, you got three whole areas of all these plants making all this great stuff and this is how it works and how many people can you cure? And he says, well, a few dozen. A few dozen. So now we know, A, why they gave it to two people and all of a sudden said they ran out. But B, I looked into it last night. Actually, the MAP Bioceuticals, I think, or Biopharmaceuticals is the name of the parent or the company that was manufacturing the, that came up with the vaccine, is a private company. They have a couple different arms, but they're all private. They are in bed. I dug it up. There are three different arms of the group that worked on the vaccine, that commercialized the vaccine, and that were the investor, one of the investor groups for the vaccine. But then the two other parties that they are in partnership with are the U.S. government and the Canadian government. So anyway, I don't know, food for thought. I just thought it was interesting that this was the last thing that Bob Simon did before he had a treacherous accident. Not cool at all, not cool at all. I don't know, I dug more into ZMapp last night, but I was getting tired. So where do we go from here? I don't know, we're down to the last few minutes. Do we have anything wacky? Backup brains, the era of digital immortality. This was on BBC. Do you want to be remembered? A few months before she died, my grandmother made a decision. Bobby, as her friends called her, was a farmer's wife who not only survived World War II, but also found it in justification for her natural hoarding talent. Waste not, want not was a principle she lived by long after England recovered from the war that left it buckled and wasted. Yet months leading up to her death, the emphasis shifted from hoarding to sharing, and every time I visited, my car would fill with stuff, blah, blah, blah. I hope she will be remembered. Nevertheless, and I don't know, what is this? I keep my grandmother's letters to me in a folder in my desk. Well, don't we all do that? Come on, dude. Is this story Total Recall? Here we go. What if, rather than simply picking and choosing what we want to capture in digital form, it was possible to record the contents of a mind in their entirety? Wow, that's like 3/4 of the way down the story it took them to even get to that point. This work is neither science fiction nor the niche pursuit of unreasonably ambitious scientists. Theoretically, the process would require 3 key breakthroughs. Scientists must first discover how to preserve non-destructively someone's brain upon their death. Then the content of the preserved brain must be analyzed and captured. And finally, that capture of the person's mind must then be recreated on a simulated human brain. And with that, we have come full circle. And you can see the picture being painted. All right, tomorrow I think we'll hop back into nanotech. We need a little nano break. But I still have more to go on that. And then who knows? We'll have to figure it out. Maybe the future plans. All right, we got about 25 seconds. It is Tuesday night. Well, it's actually Tuesday morning. But it will be Tuesday night a little bit later. Make sure you guys stick around. We have Mr. Kevin Blanche actually is live up next like he is every Tuesday and Thursday. Then we have this week's Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Halevi following that. Mr. Jack Blood is live at 3 p.m. simulcasting from RBN. And then stick around, Mr. Chuck Ocelli live at 6 p.m. Eastern. Primer Time with Michael and Nick at 9 p.m. Eastern. Perfect Chicks After Dark Roundtable at 10. And Anthem Media Radio with SM and Dedrick Young. All right, guys. Thank you for hanging out with me on this Tuesday morning. And we will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody take care.